Hi, this is Mary Jo Schottelkotte for the Holistic Half Hour on WRRS, focusing on the health of your body, mind, and spirit. Today I'm going to start a book. This was a number one New York Times bestseller. The author is Atul Gawande, and it's called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And I'll read you the back cover. Modern medicine has transformed the dangers of birth, injury, and infectious disease from harrowing to manageable. But when it comes to the inescapable realities of aging and death, what medicine can do often runs counter to what it should do. Through eye-opening research and gripping stories of his own patients and family, Gawande reveals the suffering produced by medicine's neglect of the wishes people might have beyond mere survival. To find out what those wishes are, we need to ask. We haven't been asking, but we can learn. Riveting, honest, and humane, this remarkable book, which has already changed the national conversation on aging and death, shows how the ultimate goal is not a good death, but a good life, all the way to the very end. So, a friend of mine sent this to me, and I read it. I really enjoyed what I read, and I'm sharing it with you. And this is a page about the author. Atul Gawande is the author of three other best-selling books: Complications, a finalist for the National Book Award; Better, selected by Amazon as one of the 10 best books of 2007; and The Checklist Manifesto. He is also a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a staff writer for The New Yorker, and a professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He has won the Lewis Thomas Prize for Writing About Science, a MacArthur Fellowship, and two National Magazine Awards. In his work in public health, he is executive director of Ariadna Labs, a joint center for health systems innovation, and chairman of Lifebox, a nonprofit organization making surgery safer globally. He and his wife have three children and live in Newton, Massachusetts. Introduction. I learned about a lot of things in medical school, but mortality wasn't one of them. Although I was given a dry, leathery corpse to dissect in my first term, that was solely a way to learn about human anatomy. Our textbooks had almost nothing on aging or frailty or dying. How the process unfolds, how people experience the end of their lives, and how it affects those around them seemed beside the point. The way we saw it, and the way our professor saw it, the purpose of medical schooling was to teach how to save lives, not how to tend to their demise. The one time I remember discussing mortality was during an hour we spent on the death of Ivan Ilyich, Tolstoy's classic novella. It was in a weekly seminar called Patient Doctor, part of the school's effort to make us more rounded and humane physicians. Some weeks we would practice our physical examination etiquette. Other weeks we'd learn about the effects of socioeconomics and race on health. And one afternoon we contemplated the suffering of Ivan Ilyich as he lay ill and worsening from some unnamed, untreatable disease. In the story, Ivan Ilyich is 45 years old, a mid-level St. Petersburg magistrate whose life revolves mostly around petty concerns of social status. One day, he falls off a stepladder and develops a pain in his side. Instead of abating, the pain gets worse, and he becomes unable to work. Formerly an intelligent, polished, lively, and agreeable man, he grows depressed and enfeebled. Friends and colleagues avoid him. His wife calls in a series of ever more expensive doctors. None of them can agree on a diagnosis, and the remedies they give him accomplish nothing. For Ilyich, it is all torture, and he simmers and rages at his situation. What tormented Ivan Ilyich most, Tolstoy writes, was the deception, the lie, which for some reason they all accepted, that he was not dying, but was simply ill. And he only need keep quiet and undergo a treatment, and then something very good would result. Ivan Ilyich has flashes of hope that maybe things will turn around. But as he grows weaker and more emaciated, he knows what is happening. He lives in mounting anguish and fear of death. But death is not a subject that his doctors, friends, or family can countenance. That is what causes him his most profound pain. No one pitied him as he wished to be pitied, writes Tolstoy. At certain moments after prolonged suffering, he wished most of all, though he would have been ashamed to confess it, for someone to pity him as a sick child is pitied. He longed to be petted and comforted. He knew he was an important functionary, that he had a beard turning gray, and that therefore what he longed for was impossible, but still he longed for it. As we medical students saw it, the failure of those around Ivan Ilyich to offer comfort or to acknowledge what is happening to him was a failure of character and culture. The late 19th century Russia of Tolstoy's story seemed harsh and almost primitive to us. Just as we believed that modern medicine could probably have cured Ivan Ilyich of whatever disease he had, so too we took for granted that honesty and kindness were basic responsibilities of a modern doctor. We were confident that in such a situation we would act compassionately. What worried us was knowledge. While we knew how to sympathize, we weren't at all certain we would know how to properly diagnose and treat. We paid our medical tuition to learn about the inner process of the body, the intricate mechanisms of its pathologies, and the vast trove of discoveries and technologies that have accumulated to stop them. We didn't imagine we needed to think about much else, so we put Ivan Ilyich out of our heads. Yet within a few years, when I came to experience surgical training and practice, I encountered patients forced to confront the realities of decline and mortality, and it did not take long to realize how unready I was to help them. I began writing when I was a junior surgical resident, and in one of my very first essays, I told the story of a man whom I called Joseph Lazaroff. He was a city administrator who'd lost his wife to lung cancer a few years earlier. Now he was in his 60s and suffering from an incurable cancer himself, a widely metastatic prostate cancer. He had lost more than 50 pounds. His abdomen, scrotum, and legs had filled with fluid. One day he woke up unable to move his right leg or control his bowels. He was admitted to the hospital, where I met him as an intern on the neurosurgical team. We found that the cancer had spread to his thoracic spine, where it was compressing his spinal cord. The cancer couldn't be cured, but we hoped it could be treated. Emergency radiation, however, failed to shrink the cancer, and so the neurosurgeon offered him two options: comfort care or surgery to remove the growing tumor mass from his spine. Lazaroff chose surgery. My job, as the intern on the neurosurgery service, was to get his written confirmation that he understood the risks of the operation and wished to proceed. I'd stood outside his room, his chart in my damp hand, trying to figure out how to even broach the subject with him. The hope was that the operation would halt the progression of his spinal cord damage. It wouldn't cure him, or reverse his paralysis, or get him back to the life he had led. No matter what we did, he had at most a few months to live, and the procedure was inherently dangerous. It required opening his chest, removing a rib, and collapsing a lung to get at his spine. Blood loss would be high. Recovery would be difficult. In his weakened state, he faced considerable risks of debilitating complications afterward. The operation posed a threat of both worsening and shortening his life. But the neurosurgeon had gone over these dangers, and Lazaroff had been clear that he wanted the operation. All I had to do was go in and take care of the paperwork. Lying in his bed, Lazaroff looked gray and emaciated. I said that I was an intern and that I'd come to get his consent for surgery, which required confirming that he was aware of the risks. I said that the operation could remove the tumor, but leave him with serious complications, such as paralysis or a stroke, and that it could even prove fatal. I tried to sound clear without being harsh, but my discussion put his back up. Likewise, when his son, who was in the room, questioned whether heroic measures were a good idea. Lazaroff didn't like that at all. "Don't you give up on me," he said. "You give me every chance I've got." Outside the room, after he signed the form, the son took me aside. His mother had died on a ventilator in intensive care, and at the time his father had said he did not want anything like that to happen to him. But now he was adamant about doing everything. I believed then that Mr. Lazaroff had chosen badly, and I still believe this. He chose badly not because of all the dangers, but because the operation didn't stand a chance of giving him what he really wanted, his continence, his strength, the life he had previously known. He was pursuing little more than a fantasy at the risk of a prolonged and terrible death, which was precisely what he got. The operation was a technical success. Over 8.5 hours, the surgical team removed the mass invading his spine and rebuilt the vertebral body with acrylic cement. The pressure on his spinal cord was gone, but he never recovered from the procedure. In intensive care, he developed respiratory failure, a systemic infection, blood clots from his immobility, then bleeding from the blood thinners to treat him. Each day we fell further behind. We finally had to admit he was dying. On the 14th day, his son told the team that we should stop. It fell to me to take Lazaroff off the artificial ventilator that was keeping him alive. I checked to make sure that his morphine drip was turned up high, so he wouldn't suffer from air hunger. I leaned close, and in case he could hear me, said I was going to take the breathing tube out of his mouth. He coughed a couple of times when I pulled it out, opened his eyes briefly, and closed them. His breathing grew labored, then stopped. I put my stethoscope on his chest and heard his heart fade away. Now, more than a decade after I first told Mr. Lazaroff's story, what strikes me most is not how bad his decision was, but how much we all avoided talking honestly about the choice before him. We had no difficulty explaining the specific dangers of various treatment options, but we never really touched on the reality of his disease. His oncologists, radiation therapists, surgeons, and other doctors had all seen him through months of treatment for a problem that they knew could not be cured. We could never bring ourselves to discuss the larger truth about his condition or the ultimate limits of our capabilities, let alone what might matter most to him as he neared the end of his life. If he was pursuing a delusion, so were we. Here, he was in the hospital, partially paralyzed from a cancer that had spread throughout his body. The chances that he could return to anything like the life he had even a few weeks earlier were zero. But admitting this and helping him cope with it seemed beyond us. We offered no acknowledgement or comfort or guidance. We just had another treatment he could undergo. Maybe something very good would result. We did little better than Ivan Ilyich's primitive 19th-century doctors. Worse, actually, given the new forms of physical torture we'd inflicted on our patient. It is enough to make you wonder, who are the primitive ones? Modern scientific capability has profoundly altered the course of human life. People live longer and better than at any other time in history. But scientific advances have turned the processes of aging and dying into medical experiences, matters to be managed by healthcare professionals. And we in the medical world have proved alarmingly unprepared for it. This reality has been largely hidden, as the final phases of life become less familiar to people. As recently as 1945, most deaths occurred in the home. By the 1980s, just 17% did. Those who somehow did die at home likely died too suddenly to make it to the hospital, say from a massive heart attack, stroke, or violent injury, or were too isolated to get somewhere that could provide help. Across not just the United States, but also the entire industrialized world, the experience of advanced aging and death has shifted to hospitals and nursing homes. When I became a doctor, I crossed over to the other side of the hospital doors, and although I had grown up with two doctors for parents, everything I saw was new to me. I had certainly never seen anyone die before, and when I did, it came as a shock. That wasn't because it made me think of my own mortality. Somehow the concept didn't occur to me, even when I saw people my own age die. I had a white coat on. They had a hospital gown. I couldn't quite picture it the other way around. I could, however, picture my family in their places. I'd seen multiple family members, my wife, my parents, and my children, go through serious life-threatening illnesses. Even under dire circumstances, medicine had always pulled them through. The shock to me, therefore, was seeing medicine not pull people through. I knew theoretically that my patients could die, of course, but every actual instance seemed like a violation, as if the rules I thought we were playing by were broken. I don't know what game I thought this was, but in it we always won. Dying and death confront every new doctor and nurse. The first times, some cry, some shut down, some hardly notice. When I saw my first deaths, I was too guarded to cry. But I dreamt about them. I had recurring nightmares in which I'd find my patients' corpses in my house, in my own bed. How did he get there? I wonder in panic. I knew I would be in huge trouble, maybe criminal trouble, if I didn't get the body back to the hospital without getting caught. I try to lift it into the back of my car, but it would be too heavy. Or I'd get it in, only to find blood seeping out like black oil until it overflowed the trunk. Or I'd actually get the corpse to the hospital and onto a gurney, and I'd push it down the hall after hall, trying and failing to find the room where the person used to be. "Hey!" someone would shout and start chasing me. I'd wake up next to my wife in the dark, clammy, and tachycardic. I felt that I'd killed these people. I'd failed. Death, of course, is not a failure. Death is normal. Death may be the enemy, but it is also the natural order of things. I knew these truths abstractly, but I didn't know them concretely, that they could be truths not just for everyone, but also for this person right in front of me, for this person I was responsible for. The late surgeon Sherwin Nuland, in his classic book, How We Die, lamented, "The necessity of nature's final victory was expected and accepted in generations before our own. Doctors were far more willing to recognize the signs of defeat and far less arrogant about denying them. But as I ride down the runway of the 21st century, trained in the deployment of our awesome arsenal of technology, I wonder exactly what being less arrogant really means. You become a doctor for what you imagine to be the satisfaction of the work, and that turns out to be the satisfaction of competence. It is a deep satisfaction, very much like the one that a carpenter experiences in restoring a fragile antique chest, or that a science teacher experiences in bringing a fifth grader to that sudden, mind-shifting recognition of what atoms are. It comes partly from being helpful to others. But it also comes from being technically skilled and able to solve difficult, intricate problems. Your competence gives you a secure sense of identity. For a clinician, therefore, nothing is more threatening to who you think you are than a patient with a problem you cannot solve. There's no escaping the tragedy of life, which is that we are all aging from the day we are born. One may even come to understand and accept this fact. My dead and dying patients don't haunt my dreams anymore. But that's not the same as saying one knows how to cope with what cannot be mended. I am in a profession that has succeeded because of its ability to fix. If your problem is fixable, we know just what to do. But if it's not, the fact that we have had no adequate answers to this question is troubling and has caused callousness, inhumanity, and extraordinary suffering. This experiment of making mortality a medical experience is just decades old. It is young, and the evidence is failing. This is a book about the modern experience of mortality, about what it's like to be creatures who age and die, how medicine has changed the experience, and how it hasn't, where our ideas about how to deal with our finitude have got the reality wrong. As I pass a decade in surgical practice and become middle-aged myself, I find that neither I nor my patients find our current state tolerable. But I have also found it unclear what the answers should be, or even whether any adequate ones are possible. I have the writers' and scientists' faith, however, that by pulling back the veil and peering in close, a person can make sense of what is most confusing or strange or disturbing. You don't have to spend much time with the elderly or those with terminal illness to see how often medicine fails the people it's supposed to help. The waning days of our lives are given over to treatments that addle our brains and sap our bodies for a sliver's chance of benefit. They are spent in institutions, nursing homes, and intensive care units, where regimented, anonymous routines cut us off from all the things that matter to us in life. Our reluctance to honestly examine the experience of aging and dying has increased the harm we inflict on people, and denied them the basic comforts they most need. Lacking a coherent view of how people might live successfully all the way to their very end, we have allowed our fates to be controlled by the imperatives of medicine, technology, and strangers. I wrote this book in the hope of understanding what has happened. Mortality can be a treacherous subject. Some will be alarmed by the prospect of a doctor's writing about the inevitability of decline and death. For many, such talk, however carefully framed, raises the specter of a society readying itself to sacrifice its sick and aged. But what if the sick and aged are already being sacrificed, victims of our refusal to accept the inexorability of our life cycle? And what if there are better approaches, right in front of our eyes, waiting to be recognized? Chapter 1. The Independent Self. Growing up, I never witnessed serious illness or the difficulties of old age. My parents, both doctors, were fit and healthy. They were immigrants from India, raising me and my sister in the small college town of Athens, Ohio, so my grandparents were far away. The one elderly person I regularly encountered was a woman down the street who gave me piano lessons when I was in middle school. Later, she got sick and had to move away, but it didn't occur to me to wonder where she went and what happened to her. The experience of modern old age was entirely outside my perception. In college, however, I began dating a girl in my dorm named Kathleen. And in 1985, on a Christmas visit to her home in Alexandria, Virginia, I met her mother, Alice Hobson, who was 77. I met her grandmother, Alice Hobson, who was 77 at the time. She struck me as spirited and independent-minded. She never tried to disguise her age. Her undyed white hair was brushed straight and parted on one side, Betty Davis style. Her hands were speckled with age spots and her skin was crinkled. She wore simple, neatly pressed blouses and dresses, a bit of lipstick, and heels long past when others would have considered it advisable. As I came to learn over the years, for I would eventually marry Kathleen, Alice grew up in a rural Pennsylvania town known for its flower and mushroom farms. Her father was a flower farmer, growing carnations, marigolds, and dahlias in acres of greenhouses. Alice and her siblings were the first members of their family to attend college. At the University of Delaware, Alice met Richmond Hobson, a civil engineering student. Thanks to the Great Depression, it wasn't until 6 years after their graduation that they could afford to get married. In the early years, Alice and Rich moved often for his work. They had two children, Jim, my future father-in-law, and then Chuck. Rich was hired by the Army Corps of Engineers and became an expert in large dam and bridge construction. A decade later, he was promoted to a job working with the Corps' chief engineer at headquarters outside Washington, D.C., where he remained for the rest of his career. He and Alice settled in Arlington. They bought a car, took road trips far and wide, and put away some money, too. They were able to upgrade to a bigger house and send their brainy kids off to college without need of loans. Then, on a business trip to Seattle, Rich had a sudden heart attack. He'd had a history of angina and took nitroglycerin tablets to relieve the occasional bouts of chest pain. But this was 1965, and back then doctors didn't have much they could do about heart disease. He died in the hospital before Alice could get there. He was just 60 years old. Alice was 56. With her pension from the Army Corps of Engineers, she was able to keep her Arlington home. When I met her, she'd been living on her own in that house on Greencastle Street for 20 years. My in-laws, Jim and Nan, were nearby, but Alice lived completely independently. She mowed her own lawn and knew how to fix the plumbing. She went to the gym with her friend Polly. She liked to sew and knit and made clothes, scarves, and elaborate red and green Christmas stockings for everyone in the family, complete with a button-nosed Santa and their names across the top. She organized a group that took an annual subscription to attend performances at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. She drove a big V8 Chevrolet Impala, sitting on a cushion to see over the dashboard. She ran errands, visited family, gave friends rides, and delivered meals on wheels for those with more frailties than herself. And we'll stop there. That's all the time we have for this week's edition of the Holistic Half Hour. Thanks for listening. This is Mary Jo Schottelcutty for Radio Reading Services on WRRS. Have a happy and healthy week.